mark the big book every day.
Tuesday, April 19, 2005, and this is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we'll be holding a public hearing relating to House Bill 5038, which is Department of Human Services Department-Wide Support Services. And to introduce our topic for today, we'll ask Sheila Baker-Jones to give us that update.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Today on the agenda is the caseload forecasting discussion. If you remember yesterday when we went over the agency's budget, there was a package in there that would continue some improvements that the agency had made during the interim to their forecasting unit. The topic today is going to focus on what those changes have been, what the new methodology and process for forecasting is, because the forecasting function has a significant effect on the budget proposals that you see and the information that you have to make decisions on the budget. So today we have Vic Todd and Gwen Grams from the Office of Finance and Policy Analysis, and then Paul Warner, the Legislative Revenue Officer, is here, and Tom Pakowski, the State Economist. So at this point, I think we can get into the presentation. Oh, I would ask, you have in front of you some caseload forecast books. I would ask at least initially not to delve into those because we could get lost easily in the numbers there, and we want to hear first about what the methodology and the process is before we get into the number details.
Is there going to be a bell ringing when you turn the page?
I'll come slap your hand.
Okay.
Is this data that's going to lead to the shoot?
Yes. This information will be, the information on the current forecast will be used both in the 2003-2005 rebalance and then carried forward into the 2005-2007 reshoot. So, yes, we will have other opportunities to focus on the numbers.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Vic Todd. I'm Assistant Director for Finance and Policy. And with me is Gwen Grams. And we're going to talk to you today about the new forecasting process in DHS. Today's presentation relates to pages 4 and 5 of the red tab of Department-wide support services, although we don't need to go to that area. So you don't need to use your books.
The bell didn't ring.
The bell will not ring. As I mentioned, this is a new process, and it is a very comprehensive process, and we wanted to spend time with you to really lay out just what we are doing and how it is that it's a very different process than what we've had in the past. Gwen Grams, who's the manager of the forecast unit, along with Tom Pakowski and Paul Warner, who are members of the peer review group, are going to talk to you about the challenges that this effort does represent and will continue to represent, and then just talk about perspectives around forecasting in this particular environment.
I have a question to begin. Were the techniques that you're about to describe those that were used to come up with the December numbers that were in the governor's recommended budget?
Chair Richardson, it's a mix in that this process that we're going to describe to you has really been in development for the last year and a half. And that entailed moving from one model for a limited set of forecasting to a new, more flexible model that allows us to do more work across more program areas.
Were the numbers that were included in the governor's recommended budget actual numbers based on your forecasting ability, utilizing the November data that was presented, or were there other factors involved?
Chair Richardson, I mean, the answer to that question would be yes, in that it represented the capacities we had at that time in terms of the forecasting.
Because as I looked at the numbers that were actually included in the GRB, the governor's recommended budget, and those that were presented in November, I saw some major differences. And so maybe as you go along, you could help explain those differences.
Certainly. Chair Richardson, some of the differences that you would see in the governor's recommended budget would reflect changes that were made in the governor's recommended budget from a policy standpoint. And the forecast itself is essentially a base level to begin from. And the policy issues that are then added influence what your ultimate outcomes are around caseloads.
Okay.
Is that help?
Well, I think it speak, but I, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
I think just do two broad questions first before you get started. And if you're going to answer these questions as we go along, just tell me, listen along. One is, I'd like to have some idea of how other states predict caseloads for these agencies, because I know they're difficult to predict and extremely important, especially when you're on a two-year cycle, not a one-year cycle. And you're obviously making a change, so I'd assume there's a change for a reason. Has there been, in the past, have you had significant difficulties in predicting caseload, and this is an attempt to be more accurate with those?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates. In terms of other states, I believe that Gwen will probably refer to that in general. Actually, we've worked with the state of Washington in terms of how they process this and perform this function, so she'll probably talk about that a little bit. This has been an issue for years in terms of how do you approach forecasting, estimating these programs. And the department has made several runs at this, but has never put together a structure such as what we've put together now. There are many issues behind this, and I talked about this during the phase one discussion a little bit, in that there are many different ways that caseloads are defined in the current world, many different ways that clients are defined. And so to create a comprehensive approach to this, you have to deal with that issue. And so we're in the process of dealing with that issue, and Gwen will speak to that.
One final question that comes up because of the comment that sometimes what I understood you to say is in any discrepancy between the numbers that existed in November and the numbers that were utilized in December, I think it was December 3rd, that the governor's revised budget or recommended budget came out might be policy related. How can the legislature know if the numbers that you're providing to us are actual forecasted numbers or policy driven forecasted numbers?
Mr. Chair, it's a good question. The way that the budget process works is we build a base budget, and we start that process with a forecasting process that involves both budget management and legislative fiscal office. And as we move through that process, those distinctions are there, and so. In this process, we don't spend a lot of time on the base. We tend to spend more time in discussion of policy issues and policy impacts. But those, you know, demarcations are there.
Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as we legislative fiscal office do our analysis, we look at the actions in the governor's budget and compare them to what was called the estimated budget level and what in this committee we're calling the current service level. And when we identify reductions or adjustments to that current service level, that is, I guess you could say, code for, you know, this is an adjustment to what was the initial forecast. So, for example, if in children, adults, and families, there's a $2 million reduction in foster care, then we will point that out, and it's a $2 million reduction from whatever the forecast level was for current service level. So the forecast numbers get turned into the current service level, and then we identify the governor's adjustments from that. So that's a way, I mean, it's part of our job to make it clear to you that here's what the governor did relative to the forecasts that were presented by the department in their agency request or updated information.
Okay. Please continue.
As I mentioned at the outset of the biennium, DHS had a very limited forecasting group. And when Director Weeks and Deputy Becker came in, we had a discussion about the fact that we were trying to move towards a more comprehensive approach. And essentially what they did was to accelerate that process and said, we agree this is a very important issue. And we should move this forward as rapidly as we can. And so the time frame that we put ourselves under was a very challenging time frame so that we could, at this juncture, which was the goal, was to be able to come in with this set of forecasts based upon new methodologies. And so... this, in doing this, there have been many barriers for the department, both internally and externally, in terms of achieving this. And it's just a comment that I wanted to make is that we hired Gwen in November of 2003, and at that point, she began to develop the plan, and she has done an exceptional job in getting us to this point. And now that we're at this point, all of that is lost in some sense. And I just wanted to put on the record that it's a very proud achievement that she has put this together and is able to bring this forward. And that really is all the comments that I have. And I want to turn it over to really the professionals to talk to you about the actual process at this point. So if there are any other questions of me.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning, Representative Richardson. I'll ask you please to just indulge me for a minute until I warm up. I'm a little nervous. So you probably hear it in my voice. I'm going to ask Tom Petowski and Paul Warner to join me.
Be assured that you know more about this than any of us here by far.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. I am honored today to be joined by Tom Petowski and Paul Warner, who I decided the way to introduce them as two of Oregon's most famous forecasters. It's for the forecaster contingent, I guess. Both of these gentlemen have agreed to help us as we struggle to improve our forecasting at DHS by serving on our peer review group, and I want to take this opportunity to thank them for that. They both made themselves available to us when we have those questions that come up and we need to ask somebody that knows what they're doing for advice, how do we proceed on this. So we're very appreciative that they are here with us today. I'm going to start out, run through a brief PowerPoint presentation, and please, I'm very comfortable with questions along the way. Paul and Tom are also going to talk to you just for a few minutes after this about forecasting in general and some of the challenges of forecasting, and are also available to answer questions. So with that, I'll proceed. As Vic told you, in November of 2003, with a very small group, we started out to make a plan for DHS forecasting. We started doing that by interviewing the people that we identified as the customers of a DHS forecasting process, and that included the Legislative Fiscal Office and BAM, representatives of the program staffs, representative of the budget staffs, advocates, etc. We conducted extensive interviews with our customers and tried to put together into a kind of a succinct statement what they needed from DHS forecasting. And it's up there behind you in our mission statement. They needed the DHS forecasting function to put the department in a position to be proactive about the health, safety, and independence of its clients. And we also came up with a few goals based on that. Our goal is that the caseload forecasting DHS are, number one, scientifically valid and reliable. They're timely, flexible, clearly communicated, and they're responsive to the needs of the customers, which we are defining as the program, the budget, and the legislature. our objectives for achieving these goals, or these are really our strategies, I guess, when we looked at how do we go about making sure that our forecasts are valid and reliable, our solutions were, well, we bring in some outside experts, such as Tom and Paul, but we also brought in some outside experts from other states. We talked to the Washington State Forecasting Council. We did a survey of the other states to see what kind of structures they had in place for forecasting. And in answer to your question, Senator Bates, there are about five or six other states that have the kind of setup that we do, that have an independent forecasting function within the departments. There are several other states, I can't remember the exact number, that have separate forecasting councils. So they stand alone and they are not attached to the departments they serve. And in most of the states, the forecasting function is actually done within program staff. And we'll talk a little bit about the advantages of that and the disadvantages. Going back to making our forecast valid and reliable, we also came up with a strategy that we needed to have an objective forecasting team. That is our unit. Our unit was created as part of the Office of Finance and Policy Analysis. It was a decision to keep it as a team independent of program. We also came up with a strategy of establishing an objective process for forecasting, and I'm going to go into that just a little bit. To make our forecast timely, flexible, and clear, when we really dug into the reasons behind sometimes our information not being timely, flexible, and clear, it seemed the root cause of some of those problems were that DHS as a whole was lacking standard definitions. And I'm going to talk to that a little bit, but it's one of the reasons it's sometimes awkward for us to communicate to you about our caseloads and our forecasts. Finally, to make our forecast responsive to your needs, the key things that our customers told us were that they needed to be able to predict the impact of their policies, and they needed to be able to predict the impact of policies in an integrated way. What I mean by that is we needed to know if, for example, we make a change in the Oregon health plan, what kind of impact does that have on the child welfare population? What kind of impact does that have on the mental health population? And so we're taking some steps to try to be able to look at DHS clients in an integrated way. I'm not sure that you can see this. It's also on your handout, but this slide just tells you some of the major participants in setting up this DHS forecasting process. You see that we have our forecasting unit, which is actually an independent body in finance and policy analysis, independent from the program staffs. And then we have three big external review groups. The first are our program steering committees. The steering committees actually make the decision about what gets forecast, provide us information about data sources, and information about the policy changes that are likely to occur during the course of the forecast. They're composed of BAM and Budget and Management, Legislative Fiscal Office, Program Staff, Budget Staff. The peer review group is composed of some of Oregon's foremost forecasting experts. They meet about twice a year to review our methodology and to let us, the forecasting unit, bounce our methodological quandaries off them. The peer review group consists of representatives from the Oregon University system, the state economist, Tom, the legislative fiscal office staff, budget management, Paul, the revenue officer. The final piece in our external review is we have contracted, although that contract now has expired, but we contracted with a technical team to help us put our forecasting tool and our process into place. That team was composed of people who used to work at the Washington State Forecasting Council, the ex-director there, a gentleman from Connecticut who set up Connecticut's forecasting system, and a firm called Looking Glass Analytics from Olympia, Washington, set all of that up for us. So the slide I just put up you tells you the process that is in place for forecasting at DHS now. You see it starts with a forecasting agreement. That is a written agreement that comes out of a forecast steering committee. So we put it down on paper. These are the caseloads, and this is where you can come to find the data about the caseloads. Following that written agreement, our unit goes back and works on methodology, puts it all together, gets it down on paper, and that is reviewed by the peer review group. So they take a look at, have we got some sound thinking going into this methodology? Following that, we do the data collection and the preparation and produce our base forecast. And I'm going to describe this for you in just a minute, what the base forecast is. The base forecast then is subjected to a review by the steering committees, which I described over just a minute ago. That's primarily the budget and program, LFO and BAM. Following that, we produce what we call our adjusted slash official forecast, which is the number that you see, and a risk forecast. And again, I'll describe those. And then the final piece in our process is a quality assurance review. We actually have to go in front of the DHS cabinet once a month and report to them on how close our forecast has come to the actual numbers that we see each month. Our goal from this is to keep a history. When we see some deviations of the actuals from the forecast, we need to know why, and we need to keep that history. That helps us improve in the future when we see those kind of deviations again. We produce three kinds of forecasts, as the slide here shows you. The first is called the base forecast. The base forecast is just a pure mathematical relationship between history and the future. And I'll very quickly run through our methodology with you. Most people other than forecasters find it a little boring, so I'll try to glaze over it for you. But the base, again, is just purely if history continues, this is what we would predict in the future. The adjusted...
On that.
Sure.
If you have, say there's been, like we had a recession, so supposing that you had 6 or 8 years of basic trend, and then because of a recession, utilization's gone up for 2 years, do you look at long-term, or do you look at short-term? Do you have a weighted way of doing it? Because often in looking at budgets, what I'm seeing is the most recent trend, if it's favorable toward more money, is projected up as if that's going to go on forever when it may be a bubble. How do you deal with that?
Chair Richardson, that's a very good question, and the base is not as sensitive to that as it should be. The base does project that history continues as it was going. We make adjustments for that based on what we know is happening in policy and the environment. And I'm going to speak toward the end of this about a project that we're working on now. We're trying to look at those relationships between outside variables like the economy and like the amount of time it takes someone to get to services, those kind of things, and be able to better predict what those kinds of things, what kind of impact they will have on our forecast. It's an area that we need to improve on in the future. Did that answer your question? You still look like you...
Well, what I heard you say is that, yes, but we need to work on the future, so I'm not sure if that means, yes, we do consider all of those things, or we do weight them based on the most recent history, and the way we do that is we give a double factor to the last 6 months, or... I mean, I don't have an answer on... how you do it.
Chair Richardson, excuse me. Yes, in the current forecast methodology, there's a jumping off point, which is the most current history, and the forecast is more heavily weighted toward the current history. It's a little bit of an art what time period you choose to look at in the forecast. You have to see if there have been dramatic deviations in trend lines, and you try to pick the period that best projects what looks like a constant trend. Finally, again, the adjusted slash official forecast is a forecast where we do try to model the impact that policy and the environment is going to have on our caseloads. And again, this is the bulk of our work comes into this piece. It's often difficult to predict the impact of policy, and we're heavily reliant on trying to find research studies. Again, they're not always there. Trying to find data that might suggest the way these things are going to go. The final forecast that we present then is what we call a risk forecast. The risk forecast models those policy changes in a couple of ways where we don't have enough data really to make a decision, but we have program and policy staff telling us that they very much from their experience believe that that this kind of a risk is going to happen. It's most art of all of the three forecasts. It's heavily reliant on the feedback from the program staff and the outside experts. All right, our base methodology, it's basically uses three components. We look at our existing clients, and that's the jump-off point I was referring to, Representative Richardson. And then we add to that the clients that we have seen in the past transferring into a program from other programs. So, for example, we've had a lot of activity lately in the Oregon Health Plan when the standard program was undergoing a lot of changes. We saw a lot of changing activity in the transfer patterns of clients from the plus from the standard program going into the plus program. So we add those transfer clients to the existing clients. And then the third component are the new clients. And we try to project the new clients based on past history of new clients coming into the system. We have a very sophisticated model now that allows us to choose a trend that best fits our data based on 20 different forecasting methods, and we choose the best fit. The challenges that we face, and I alluded to these a little bit earlier, DHS has grown up as a collection of independent programs, largely driven by federal requirements. And so we've grown up in consistently in many ways. I'll show you some slides on this, but I think one of the things that you often experience when you have DHS staff come in front of you and you ask us a question like, how many clients do you have? We have a lot of different definitions of who the clients are, and we have a lot of different ways to count those clients, and a lot of those did grow out of, you know, this is the way this program was built, this is the way the feds have wanted us to count clients in the past. We have a lot of definitions just of what is a service. We don't have a consistent, if you ask one program in DHS what a service is, they may have a different definition of it than another program in DHS. We have a lot of different levels of expertise on counting and forecasting and et cetera. You don't have to look at all of these, but I put this slide up here just to give you an example. When our unit came together, one of the first jobs that we had was to look at the current definitions of a client. And I put the et cetera at the bottom because we could go on. But you see that there are many, many different ways that you could call someone a client. Since we did this exercise and worked with many of the programs, our cabinet actually has adopted now a consistent DHS definition of client that we would like to use whenever we talk to you. We're still working on getting adopted program-wide. I know it sounds difficult to understand this probably from the outside, but this is a big change for our department, for us to come to some kind of a consistent definition. It takes a little time to get the data systems and to get the program staff all to come to this common understanding, but we are working on it. And our definition of a client is a uniquely identifiable individual who receives at least one DHS client-based service or benefit, and I'll tell you what that is in just a second. You may have heard also another kind of definition that gets sometimes crossed with the definition of client. That's a case. A case is actually, in our new definition, a group of individuals, one or more of whom is a client, and this group of individuals is aggregated together for different purposes. So, for example, I think you may have heard about food stamp cases, and you may have heard of TANF cases. Those actually are defined by the federal government for us. Food stamp cases are people that eat together. TANF cases are people that live together. So case may mean something a little bit different. This definition helps us to communicate it to you in the same way. Finally, an important distinction, the clients are separate in some ways from our workload. There are people that come to DHS and create work for us. They either are applying for services or we're having to investigate something, but they never really achieve client status. And it's possible sometimes that the workload can be reported in there with the client caseload. So in the future, we're going to try to be very careful to use these definitions whenever we talk to you about a client, a case, or a workload. Any questions about that? And this is just a demonstration that the caseload is distinct from the workload. The workload includes everybody who gets screened and the people who receive the service, whereas the caseload is the people who receive the service. And here is the definition of service. Remember, so a client is a uniquely identifiable individual who receives at least one service. DHS provides a large array of services, but we can break them into two big categories. One is the population-based services, and those are aimed at the things like drinking water and restaurant inspections. We don't have a uniquely identifiable individual receiving that service. Our unit does not work with the people in that outer ring of the population-based services. We work with these two inner rings of people receiving client-based services. And there are two types of these client-based services. The first is where we work with somebody directly, hands-on, time after time. The second is where we are pretty much sending them a check. They're getting a benefit from us. It's something like food stamps or their health insurance coverage. This next slide is intended to show you kind of, or try to make it clear why it can be confusing sometimes when you ask for a client count. It seems like that should be a really simple thing. Well, how many clients do you have? Well, that depends on how we're counting them. If you look at just this very simple slide, look at where the month begins, that orange box. You see, if we count clients as anyone who gets served within that month, then we'll tell you that we had three clients. If we count clients as an average daily population, then we'll tell you that we had 1.33 clients. If we count clients as the people who entered service during the month, we'll tell you we had two clients. And so another thing that DHS is adopting when we communicate to you is from now on when we talk to you about our client caseload, we will be telling you about our average daily population of clients. If we're talking about something else, like how many people we served in that month, we'll be very clear that that's what we're talking to you about at that point.
Ask a question. Does this only relate to DHS or Human Services?
Representative Richardson, yes.
There's a similar move towards standardization in, like, education, Department of Education, or do you know?
Representative Richardson, not that I know of, but it's a pretty good idea.
Thank you. I just wanted to
You're inspiring me. I'm thinking maybe I should be contacting my colleagues.
I think so. Presently, my understanding is when they talk about cost per student, it's any student that stepped in the door within a year instead of average daily attendance, which is a whole lot different.
Representative Richard, yes, very different. You can get lots of different answers depending on how you count. So this is my summary slide, and then I'm going to turn it over to Tom and Paul. And remember at the beginning I told you about the objectives that we put in place. This is our self-assessment of how far we've come toward achieving these objectives in about the past year. We do believe we have in place a process where objective expert review guides all of our forecast decisions. we're close, but we're not quite there to having the central objective unit doing the forecast for all of the client-based services. We still have a couple of small forecasts that we have not completed yet, but they're coming. We're about 60% of the way toward using consistent definitions and forecasting tools. We do have the standard definitions. They've been adopted by Cabinet, and we're working now to make sure that they're used throughout DHS. Maybe a little bit under half about being able to track our clients across the different clusters and caseloads. And I'd actually refer you to something in your packet. These colored, we call them our Easter egg charts. This is something that we're actually able to produce for a first time now. When you may have wanted to know how many children or adults DHS has served, we haven't been able to know how many unique individuals the department served because we have not had a unique way to identify the person across all of the different programs and services. We now have an integrated client database where we are able to tell that that same person who got services in mental health is the same person who got services in the health plan or was seen in child welfare. And so we brought you these charts as a demonstration to show you the complexity, number one, I guess, in that we do have some ability now to look at our clients across DHS. And then finally, our goal of being able to predict the impact of social and environmental change, as Representative Richardson was asking about earlier, I think we're 37.5% of the way toward that one. This is just finally a list of the programs that we are currently forecasting, and you see that developmental disabilities is to come. And with that, unless there are any questions, I'm going to turn it over to Paul Warner.
Questions? Ms. Baker.
Gwen, maybe I'd just like to get on the record the role of the forecasting unit compared to what happens later in budgeting, and what point does the forecast go to and where does budget take over?
Representative Richardson, Sheila, thank you. Yes, our unit produces in the actual spreadsheets showing the client counts, and those, as soon as our forecast steering committees have agreed, and it's a formal process if they agree that this is the official slash final forecast, those spreadsheets then go over to the budget units, and the cost per case is applied against those caseloads, and that's what goes into the budget.
Is your data available to the public?
Representative Richardson, absolutely, yes. We are putting it up on a website. You see our forecasting books in front of you, which you're not supposed to open, but... Yes, those are all posted on the website. The other thing that we are working on right now is an interactive website where someone, say, from Marion County could go in and do a query on how many mental health and alcohol drug clients or something were in Marion County and would be able to actually go in and produce a spreadsheet for their county showing the array of services.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moss Anderson.
Thank you. Is this forecasting going to be an ongoing thing, or, I mean, like on a, you come out with numbers for every month? I mean, I know the legislature needs their numbers, or if you see all of a sudden you have many more people than you thought, you need to come before either the legislature or the e-board, but so this is something continuous.
Representative Richardson, Senator Anderson, yes, we produce forecasts every 6 months, but we monitor the actual client counts on a monthly basis. And those reports will also be posted on the web.
And follow-up, has this been done previously? Have you always had to produce numbers?
Representative Richardson, Senator Anderson, our unit has produced the medical assistance program, or an independent unit, not the unit that exists now, produced the medical assistance program and the aged and physically disabled forecast. It's new that mental health, addiction, I'm blanking out on the rest, but that the rest of these forecasts are being done by a central unit. There has been some form of forecasting done. within each of these programs to drive the budget, but again, it was using different methodologies generally done by program staff that had that as a small piece of their job.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Officer, and I just want to make clear for the record, after 13 years of forecasting revenue in two different states, I consider myself a recovering forecaster.
Well known, nevertheless.
I've watched DHS struggle over the years. My time here goes back to 1989, and try to wrestle with trying to set up systems. There have been various efforts. I remember the Adult and Family Service caseload forecasting efforts over the years. And so I've seen them, and this is the most systematic step that they've taken, I think, certainly to centralize the efforts. One of the comparisons that strikes me is one I was involved with in the mid-90s, and that is the forecasting of the prison population and then eventually the OIA population, which I think has some similar kinds of problems in terms of forecasting or challenges,
AOI.
As Gwen points out.
Yes. AOI.
OYA.
OYA.
Sorry. Did I say OYA?
No, I probably heard it wrong.
The Oregon Youth Authority caseload, which similar to some of the caseload forecasts that are done by DHS, is very interactive with policy. And so it's hard to separate the two, and so you have to have a clear distinction and set some assumptions about what policy is and make the caseload projections consistent with that policy assumption. I just wanted to point out three things that I think are very important in the forecasting process, particularly in a political environment where you're providing forecasts to policymakers. The first I would say is to produce unbiased results. And I think you have to have confidence that the results you're getting are unbiased and they're not conservative or liberal or any way influenced by any factor other than trying to be accurate. What that means is
the possibility of multiple schematics. In other words, you say, assuming that we have a continuing recovery, it is X. Assuming we have the 40-year average rate of inflation, it is Y. I mean, because whatever assumptions you make, it's going to determine the outcome. And so if you make an assumption and then you give one outcome, then you're stuck with it when mm-hmm. there's, you know, a different set of premises come into play. How do you mm-hmm. deal with that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think a couple things. One is you do have a baseline forecast, external forecast that Tom produces that you've got every quarter. And then there's also a demographic forecast that goes with that in terms of population growth and growth of the different age groups. So those, you have a base external forecast to work from. Now, I agree with you that the next step is to say, well, what if some of these things don't happen? What if Oregon does go into a recession in 2006, even though that's not part of the baseline forecast? So I think that kind of range estimates are very important to do. I think the key, though, here, that the unbiased results is to come up with something that is a midpoint in a range of possible outcomes. Now, I'm not saying accurate. That's a very different term than being accurate. I'm saying it has to be unbiased, meaning there's an equal probability of being too high or too low. And so I would see that as a very, very key element of a forecast process. The second thing I think is very important, and Gwen has talked about this, is an independent a forecasting unit. That can be done a number of ways. As Vic pointed out, that Washington has gone for years with their Office of Financial Management, has done a separate caseload forecasting unit. But I think that rather than the necessarily the form, the independence is very important. Because it's very hard when you're managing the program to be independent and give you that unbiased estimate. I also think that's an important element, important role for the outside review group that Tom and I are on, is to give an independent look, to provide an unbiased look on things. We obviously have no vested interest in the outcome other than to try to provide some objective assessment of how we see things from our perspective. The second point I would make about a forecasting system is that you need to have a system to analyze your errors and respond to the changing environment. I think this gets also at your point, Mr. Chair, is that as that environment changes, you have to be able to adapt your forecast to it, adapt when your assumptions are not right. And I think you really two steps allow you to do that. One is to have a model that models those relationships. Models don't necessarily have some magical ability to predict the future. But what they do is they force you to systematically lay out your assumptions and what relationships you think are important and specifically how those relationships are to work. Then reality steps in and you realize when you do the analysis of the forecast after you've got the actual data that here's some problems with the assumptions, this relationship was not modeled correctly. So you have to have that feedback system of continually reviewing and analyzing your forecast. I think this also gets back to a question that Senator Mona Sanderson raised about how often do you do the forecast. I think it's very important to have a regular systematic forecast schedule so that you know when forecasts are coming out, you know you've got what the latest information is, and then the system is going through and reviewing it and responding to whatever errors there are and what changing external environment there is. Again, from an outside review standpoint, I think that's an important role, particularly to look at that external environment and to build the things in that may not be as familiar with those that are actually managing the programs. I don't think I'm often asked what is a reasonable range of error to expect. I think the answer to that is it varies widely depending on what it is you're forecasting. I mean, you saw some pretty radically, some very large errors in terms of caseload forecasting in 2002, but of course the environment changed very significantly during that period, and the policy changed very significantly. So depending on the forecast, I think the range of error can vary a lot. And that brings me to my last point, and that is that I think a forecast process has to assess and communicate risk. My favorite story on trying to interpret forecasters is when General Eisenhower was preparing for D-Day, one of the key variables for him was the weather. So he made sure in the months leading up to D-Day that he communicated with his weatherman every day, and he wanted to know exactly what his assessment of risk was and how to interpret what his forecasts were and how much confidence he had. And I think that's very important, too, that for the DHS unit or any forecasting unit is to give you a sense of what their level of confidence is. And they are responsible for evaluating that range of possible outcomes and letting you know, here's an unbiased forecast, but we think for these reasons there's a wide range of possibilities, or alternatively, we think we're in a stable environment. We're pretty confident that this thing's going to be very close, so that they give you the best sense possible of what that range of outcomes
are. Do you do unexpected updates if things change? For instance, supposing that California legislature has, under the guidance of the Terminator, lowered all benefits to 85% of federal poverty level. Mm-hmm. Or if they got a waiver or something like that, mm-hmm. that could have a huge impact on the caseload in Oregon, since there could be a tremendous number of people who would then look around and say, where could we go and get better benefits? And I mean, would that, if there was that kind of an occurrence, mm-hmm. would that be something that's brought up immediately, or would you wait to the next round, or just kind of wait and see, or how do you deal with that?
That's a very good question, Mr. Chair. The systems that I've been involved in have always stuck to a regular interval because there's too much risk of setting a precedent that, it's time to rerun the numbers, or because the risk is that you lose some of that unbiased objectivity and you tend to be very difficult to lay out what would be the exact reasons to do that. But I can see logically where there may be a time to do that. One of the things I remember going way back was releasing a forecast the day after the stock market crashed in 87. I remember when it dropped 500 points, and we thought, oh, boy, we're going to have to delay the forecast release. And we made the decision not to, and it turned out it didn't have much effect in terms of the overall real economy. But I can see your point where there may be certainly in your budget environment where you may want to do that. But I think that should be very rare.
Okay.
Finally, I would just make the point that in terms of assessing and communicating risk, again, I think that looking at similar processes, I mentioned the Department of Corrections prison inmate population, the economic forecasts that are done, there's forecasts on school enrollment. Those all have a similar process. They're all trying to achieve an objective estimate for policymakers, and I think that kind of interaction can help in assessment and communicating risks. I will conclude by saying I think DHS has taken some steps to set up a system that can accomplish these key elements for a forecasting process.
For the record, my name is Tom Kutkowski with the Office of Economic Analysis, Department of Administrative Services. I can just simply reiterate, really, what Paul has just mentioned. I won't make the very long comments here, but to reiterate, definitely an unbiased forecast is very desirable because you have to make decisions not based really on, well, you probably have to make some decisions based on politics, but the information you receive should be stripped of any of those aspects. So that policy and budgets should not determine the forecast, but your forecast should have the flexibility to analyze the impact that policies and budgets could have on, say, caseloads. Cooperation is also very, very important for effective use of these forecasts. The independent sort of part of DHS that's going to be doing the forecast has to have very strong cooperation with all the different agencies under DHS to provide timely information, information that is quality and is in a standardized form that can be used for the forecasting process. And I know that cooperation is very, very important because when I took the state economist job, the former state economist kept a lot of information from me about the job that was crucial later on to know.
You wanted him to say yes.
I still have it in my file drawer.
and then also for the forecast process, accountability is also very important. You have to have your forecast methodology laid out. If there are any changes in that methodology, that needs to be made public to committee members, to the general public. Also, tracking of the information, as Gwen said, you can only correct errors if you know where they are and you can understand why they came about, and that can help in your forecast process. And then your review committees help very much in your accountability. As you were saying, Chair Richardson, you know, in history and the forecast, the history sets, in a sense, the sensitivity of what you believe the future might be or changes, the sensitivity that happened in the past, then that might be the sensitivity in the future. Your review committees can help you assess that sensitivity, whether they think it's as strong as that or as weak as it had been in the past. I think a perfect example right now is the energy crisis, where our sensitivity was probably much higher back in history, back in the late 70s and 80s, when we were much more dependent on the use of energy, as opposed to today, where our sensitivity is still there, but we'd have to have oil prices going up much, much higher to get the same kind of impact that we got back in the late 70s and early 80s. So the review committees are very, very important in that respect. And also just a comment where Paul was mentioning, too, about, you know, you have some event that may happen in between your regular forecasts. The last one we kind of dealt with in a very serious way was the 9/11 event. That was right after our September 1 forecast, and we were wondering then what might be the impact on our economy because of this event. And what you do there is you can make just a quick assessment. I don't think you necessarily go through your entire modeling process because that would basically take you to the next quarterly forecast to come out. But you do present an assessment that you present to, we presented to the governor, to the leadership, as to what we might see as a possible impact on the state from those events.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Moss Anderson.
In order to have a good forecast, you've got to have the data, and the data has to come from some bodies. So how much extra work, or is there any extra work, that the various agencies, have they had to change forms? Have they had to change the way they data enter? I mean, how has this trickled down to the people who are actually dealing with the cases so that you get the proper numbers?
Representative Richardson, Senator Anderson, we've been keeping them pretty busy. One of our most important jobs is the quality checks on the data that we get in from the programs, and because we have asked them to change some definitions, they're having to do some writing some new programs to pull the data. We actually work with the data ourselves, so we get episodic information. We require it to come into us in a standard format, and then we do the process of quality check. Does it make sense? Sometimes we have to send them back and have them do it over. And so I'd say we've kept them very busy. Did that answer your question?
Yes, having worked for a county and managed a program, many programs, maybe some will find it more difficult than others.
Representative Richardson and Senator Anderson, yes, I would say that the medical assistance program is used to working with us and having to provide those kinds of data. So it's much easier for them than some of the other places that are used to dealing in cases instead of in individuals. And we're requiring them now to give us information about the individuals instead of the cases.
Are there other questions? Further information? Does that complete the presentation for today?
Representative Richardson, yes, thank you.
Thank you very much.
It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Rarely.
Well, that
we really aren't in
that.
Security
now, we start to feel questions.
Now, are there other matters that need to come up before this committee today?
Mr. Britton, just to reiterate, the department will be showing you what their forecasts are for the remaining part of this biennium when we look at the rebalance in about 2 weeks, and it will also then inform you about what the forecasts will be for the reshoot, for the repricing of the governor's budget. And you'll actually, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Gwen, you're going to be showing graphs and charts and all of that kind of good stuff.
Representative Richardson, John, I'm not sure that I'll be here doing that, but it will be included in the budget presentations.
Good. Thank you. Thanks.
Tomorrow's agenda?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, tomorrow we start phase two of the children, adults, and families. We'll do that Wednesday and Thursday, and then we expect public testimony on CAF on Monday and Tuesday of next week, and my hope is that we can separate out the public testimony so that Monday would be vocational rehabilitation services and the self-sufficiency programs, and then Tuesday would be child welfare, so that we can try and keep it more topically concentrated, if you will, for members.
Okay. Is it
thank you, Mr. Chair. Question concerning the Ways and Means Committee will be doing a hearing in Tillamook on Wednesday, and will that impact our Thursday morning schedule?
I was just, our minds are thinking the same way. I was going to say, since three of us or four of us here are the ones that we're often here, plus Senator Ramona Sanderson, my thought is that we would go ahead and hold the meeting on Thursday, because those that are likely to attend anyway are likely to be here, and it's not a work session, and those that aren't here for 50 cents can get a DVD of the hearing and watch it later. But I just hate to lose a day because we have so much to cover.
Wait, is Tillamook Wednesday or Thursday?
It's Wednesday night.
Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, if Bill really has a strong feelings about it, I'd like to go ahead and hold our meeting on Thursday. Yeah. You all right? It's all right with you? Will you be with us? All right. Then we'll go ahead with that. And tonight, do we have anything? Or is it tomorrow night?
Lake Ridge tonight.
Lake Ridge.
Tonight it's really scheduled for the department or the education subcommittee from Ways and Means.
Okay. general Ways and Means has nothing till tomorrow night, and that's Tillamook.
Okay.
Right?
That's correct.
Okay. Shoot.
Question, Mr. Chair. Sheila brought me out of my daydreaming when she said, so the committee can focus tomorrow. I missed what came
in front. She was talking to you, but she
kind of I understand that, but, you know, two-by-fours, hammers are good stimuli for me when you're trying to get my... You were talking about...
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, the schedule as planned at this point anyway is to have the phase two discussion on children, adults, and families tomorrow and Thursday, and then public testimony would be the following Monday and Tuesday, and my plan, if we can do it, is to have public testimony on the part of the CAF budget that deals with self-sufficiency programs and vocational rehabilitation on Monday, and then child welfare on Tuesday, rather than having everybody from all of those program areas coming in both days.
So we can focus on the...
Well, that also makes sense because some people who might want to be just on one area would have to come and then wouldn't get to speak, and so they end up making two trips, and so it would respect their time, I think, if they knew what the topic was.
Good planning.
Sounds good. Senator Montanerson, we just were mentioning that for those that can attend on Thursday, we're going to go ahead and hold a committee meeting on Thursday, and if anyone is unable to because of a late night, Wednesday night, they get the, you know, the CD and it's 50 cents and or DVD and watch it. But if without strong objection, I think that we don't really have the time to afford to lose it to our meeting. So, are there other items we need to address today? Seeing none, then we will be adjourned. Thank you.